Chapter 6. Finally, Matt woke and knew that he was well. His body was no longer on fire. He could open his eyes, and he saw that sunlight glinted through the chinks in the roof. All his familiar things were around him. The shelves with the pewter dishes, his jacket hanging on a peg. He felt as though he had been on a long journey and had come home. He must have slept through half a day and a night. When the cabin door opened and the Indian entered, Matt hastily pulled himself up. Now, with clear eyes, he saw that there was nothing in the least strange about this man. He was dressed not so differently from Matt's own father, in a coat of some rough brown cloth and leggings fringed down the side. His face was smooth-shaven, and so was his whole head, except for one long black topknot. When he saw that Matt was awake, his stern face was lighted by a wide smile. "Good." It was half word, half grunt. "White boy, very sick. Now well." Matt remembered his father's advice. "Good morning," he said respectfully. The Indian pointed a hand at his own chest. "Sackness, family of Beaver," he said. He seemed to be waiting. "I'm Matthew Halliwell," Matt answered. "Good. White man leave you here?" "Just for a while," Matt told him. "He is gone to get my mother." It did not occur to him to lie to this old man as he had to Ben. Moreover, he knew that there was something he had to say. He tried to find the right words. "I'm grateful to you," he said finally. "It was a very lucky thing you happened to find me. We watch. White boy very foolish to climb bee tree." So he had been right, Matt thought, that eyes were watching him from the forest. He was sure that the Indian had not asked him where he lived. They had brought him straight home to his cabin. Even though he knew it was his good fortune they'd been watching him yesterday, he still felt somewhat resentful of their spying. Abruptly, he swung his feet to the floor and winced as a sharp pain ran up his leg. The Indian noticed, and moving closer, he took Matt's ankle between his hands and pressed gently with his fingers. "Is it broken?" Matt asked. "Nada. Not broke. Mend soon. Sleep now. Not need medicine more." The Indian had put something on the table as he came in. When he had gone, Matt hobbled over to see what it was and found a wooden bowl of stew, thick and greasy, flavored with some strange plant, wonderfully filling and strengthening. With it there was a cake of cornbread, coarser than his own, but delicious. The next day the Indian brought the boy with him. "Nequinus, you call grandson," he announced. "Atene." The two boys stared at each other. The Indian boy's black eyes held no expression whatever. Unlike the old man, he was naked except for a breechcloth held up by a string at his waist. It passed between his legs and hung down like a little apron back and front. His heavy black hair fell straight to his shoulders. "Atene, same winter as white boy, maybe?" the man asked. He held up 10 fingers and then 4 more. "I'm 13, Matt answered, holding up his own fingers. "At least," he excused himself, "that would be true in another week." The Indian boy did not speak a word. Quite plainly, he had been brought here against his will. He stared about the cabin and seemed to despise everything he saw. He made Matt feel like a fool, sitting with his leg propped up on a stool. Matt steadied himself on his good leg and stood up. Now he noticed that Sackness was holding out to him a rough sort of crutch. Matt wished he did not have to try it right now, with both of them watching him, but he could see that the man expected it. He managed a few steps, furious at his own clumsiness. He had never imagined how pesky a crutch could be. Moreover, although there was not the slightest change in the boy's face, Matt was sure that Atene was laughing at him. There was a nasty little gleam in the boy's eyes. The moment they were gone, he seized the crutch in earnest, and very soon he could swing himself along at a good brisk pace. Now he was able to get about outside the cabin to check the corn patch and bring in firewood. The trouble was, he had only one boot. The woolen stocking his mother had knit for him was wearing thin. On the rough ground it was wore through in no time. This, too, the Indian noticed when he came with his grandson next morning. "No boot," he said, pointing. "I lost it," Matt answered. "It came off in the mud when I ran." Once again he felt ridiculous under the Indian boy's black stare. 3 days later, Sackness brought him a pair of moccasins. They were handsome and new, of moose hide, dark and glistening with grease, tied with stout thongs that were long enough to wrap about his ankles. Beaver woman make, Sakna said. Better white man's boots. White boy see. Matt took off one boot and slipped on the moccasins. Indeed, they were better. In fact, they were wonderful. Not stiff like new leather boots. Not knobby or pinching anywhere. Light as nothing at all when he lifted his feet. No wonder Indians did not make a sound when they walked in the forest. Shame suddenly flooded Matt. This man had perhaps saved his life, had come bringing food and a crutch and now these beautiful moccasins. It wasn't enough just to say an awkward thank you. He needed to give something in return, not money. There were a few silver coins in the tin box, but something made him very sure that he could not offer money to this proud old man. He looked about him in despair. There was almost nothing of his own in the cabin. Then he spied the two books on the shelf, the only two his father had been able to carry into the wilderness. One was a Bible. He dared not give away his father's Bible. The other book was his own, the only one he had ever possessed, Robinson Crusoe. He had read it a dozen times, and the thought of parting it was painful, but it was the only thing he had to give. He hobbled across the room and took it down from the shelf and held it out to the Indian. Sakna stared at it. "It's for you," Matt said. "It's a gift. Please take it." Sacknus reached out and took the book in his hand. He turned it over and over slowly, his face showing not a sign of pleasure. Then he opened it and stood peering at the page. With shame, Matt saw that he was holding it upside down. He couldn't read. Of course he couldn't. Matt should have known that. He had made a terrible mistake and embarrassed a good man. He had heard once that the one thing an Indian could never forgive was a hurt to his pride. He felt his own face burning. But Sakness did not look embarrassed. His dark stare went from the book to Matt's face. "White boy no signs?" he asked. Matt was puzzled. "White boy read what white man write here?" "Yes," Matt admitted, "I can read it." For a long moment the Indian studied the book. Then astonishingly that rare white smile flashed. "Good," he grunted. "Sakness make treaty." "A treaty?" Matt was even more puzzled. "Nikwinis, hunt. Bring white boy bird and rabbit. White boy teach a teen white man signs." "You mean I should teach him to read?" "Good. White boy teach a teen what books say." Doubtfully, Matt looked from the old man to the boy who stood silently listening. His heart sank. The scorn in the boy's face had turned to black anger. "Nada!" The furious word exploded, the first word Matt had ever heard him speak. Half under his breath, he muttered a string of incomprehensible words. His grandfather's stern face did not change. He was undisturbed by the boy's defiance. "A teen learn," he said. "White man come more and more to Indian land. White man not make treaty with pipe. White man make signs on paper. Signs Indian not know. Indian put mark on paper to show him friend of white man. Then white man take land. Tell Indian cannot hunt on land. A teen learn to read white man's signs. A teen not give away hunting grounds." The boy glowered at his grandfather, but he did not dare to speak again. With a black scowl, he stalked out of the cabin. "Good," said Sakness calmly. He handed the book back to Matt. "A teen comes Ziba tomorrow."